Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name is Gary Thacker, and we're back with another visit to the Mount Rushmore Debating Hall. In this episode, we're focusing on the FA Cup, offering a wide sweep of options ranging from the first tournament in 1872 right up to the current date. The advocates have submitted in order of preference a list of three options for each of the categories of goalkeeper, defender, midfielder, forward and coach. I then collate them into a final list to avoid duplication. I'm delighted to say that guys have not only looked so to relatively contemporary times, but also cast their nets back into the early years of the competition. Each advocate will have 3 minutes to make their pitches to the judge, that's me, and I'll decide who has delivered the most convincing argument persuading me to declare them their selection as the most worthy earning a place on this particular Mount Rushmore. At this stage, only I know which players and managers each advocate has been allocated from their initial selections. All will be revealed in good time. But I'm allowed to say that there's a bit of few inspired inclusions and perhaps some surprising omissions too. A few things worth noting before we start. Firstly, I'm delighted to confirm that each of the advocates have their first choice selections across all five categories. So, gentlemen, no excuses. Secondly, only one player featured across all three advocate selections, but only one select him as their first choice. Finally, when a player has been selected by more than one advocate, but in different positions, the Mount Rushmore debate convention is to rule out that player from both advocates. In this episode, however, the player selected both as a defender and a forward had played in lots of positions. So, after a little research, I decided that because he played in every position except goalkeeper, he was therefore accepted as one advocate's first choice. So, anyway, that's enough of the preamble. Let's get down to it and introduce our advocates. In alphabetical order, first we have TFT's very own North East correspondent, a Newcastle fan, who has never forgiven me for selecting Panenka above Platini. It's Aidan Williams. No one from your first choice selection, Aidan, from your area. Are you avoiding any conflict of interest, buddy?
Well, there's some from my area, Gary, just not necessarily playing in black and white.
Yes, true.
So we'll get to that. So, yeah, we will get to that. I did have other black and white ones further on my list, anticipating alternative options. But, you know, I'm happy with what I've gone for. I'm slightly in trepidation of what some others might have gone for. But, you know, they will get all abuse that they deserve.
Setting the scene there for an over-the-top tackle on the thigh-high tackle, or studs up and all that sort of thing. Secondly, an advocate, a regular advocate's row, and the man who has a well-earned reputation for his left field selections in this debate, Dave Bowler. Dave, I know who you've selected, and I know you've underscored that rep again, buddy, haven't you?
Thank you very much. None of them are as good as Panenka versus Platini, obviously. But
good man.
Yeah, we try.
Good man. Finally, completely free advocates, it's TFT's own football hipster, Stevie Scragg. Plenty of research going into this one, Stevie, and a little like Aidan's approach, I note that of the 80 men submitted by you, only one was Anfield related.
Indeed. I could have gone for A. Clements as my goalkeeper, as I normally do with these Mount Rushmore episodes. I resisted the urge to do so. The one Liverpool player kind of like makes total sense. I grew up with the FA Cup being, you know, the one trophy that kind of like other teams were allowed to win during the 1980s while we won everything else, basically. So, yeah, I just felt I should have, I had to kind of like subscribe to that the FA Cup is for everyone kind of vibe. But just wait until I pit Panenka, though, later on.
Aidan, you're never going to be able to forget this, mate. So you know it, don't you? The outcry
on it, I think, is coming from across the board, and it just shows that I was right all along.
Just for the record, the judge is never wrong. And we don't want any contempt of court, so we have no arguments about that. Anyway, okay, let's get the ball out of a kick about. I'm going to go for Christian names alphabetically. So, Aidan, and you can't choose Platini as your goalkeeper. But let's say, you know, in the FA Cup, across those years from 1872 to where we are now, tell me who your goalkeeper is. You have 3 minutes starting now.
Great FA Cup tales are all about the backstory, and not many have a story quite like that of Bert Trautmann. With a stint in the Hitler Youth in their formative years, followed by action as a paratrooper and winning an Iron Cross on the Eastern Front, as well as the FA Cup. Later reassigned in the war to the Western Front, he was one of only a few survivors of a huge bombing raid, went AWOL to escape the horrors, got captured, escaped, got captured again, before seeing out the war in a POW camp in Lancashire. He'd played outfield in the regular camp football matches, only going in goal initially because he got injured and couldn't run. But he obviously did all right, though, because from that day on, he was always in goal. Now, unusually, I guess, he opted to stay in Lancashire after his release in 1948, combining working on a farm with disposing of bombs in the Highton area of Merseyside and playing in goal for St. Helens Town in the Liverpool Combination League. He helped them to their first ever trophy in 1949 and also helped himself to the club secretary's daughter, who he later married. But later that year, now aged 26, his reputation was such that top flight Man City took him on in a rather controversial move. Obviously, signing a former German paratrooper caused a little bit of a stir, and he received relentless abuse everywhere he went. But he soon silenced the skeptics, becoming one of the best keepers in England. His ability to throw the ball out accurately rather than just hoof it as far as possible, as was the norm at the time, was crucial to City's rather progressive possession-based style. It took them to the FA Cup final 2 years running in 55 and 56. In 1955, they were outdone and outclassed, here's the Newcastle reference, Gary, by Jackie Milburn and Newcastle United, Cup Kings of the time, conceding after only 45 seconds as City lost. But a year later, they were back. And in Trautmann, they now had the reigning Football Writers Player of the Year in 1956. Against Birmingham City, they were the better team in that final, going 3-1 up in the second half. But then, and here we go, in the 75th minute, Trautmann dived for a ball and was knocked out in a collision with Birmingham's Peter Murphy, taking a whack in the neck. No subs in those days, of course, so we have a dazed and confused Trautmann playing on, despite being clearly rather unsteady on his feet. In the remaining minutes of that game, he made several key saves as Man City held on to win, making him the hero of the day. As he got his medal, Prince Philip commented on how crooked his neck appeared, and that evening's winner's banquet, he was unable to even move his head, with a broken neck only confirmed a few days later. Quite how he kept his life intact is astonishing enough, let alone how he managed to keep City's goal intact in those final minutes. As legendary FA Cup moments go, I think that one is hard to top. I don't care what these other goalkeepers may have done. None of them played the starring role in an FA Cup win in quite such incredible circumstances.
Be interesting how the other guys go, but as for timing, mate, it's 2:57.86. That's perfect timing. It's interesting that I don't know if you intentionally did it, but Dazed and Confused was a track on a Led Zeppelin LP, which relates to the Second World War. Is that intentional or is that just a...
That was clearly subliminal. It must have been in there somewhere.
There you go, buddy. There you go. I mean, it's great.
Picture. Extra points for that, though.
Well, it's steady on there. Steady on. So, alphabetically, David, you're next. And, you know, throughout these first choices, there's a number of players who I looked at and I thought, who? Typical left field, Dave. You pick one of those. Away you go, buddy.
I think the FA Cup is the greatest competition of the lot. I think that's what football is all about, the FA Cup. And so for this, I've tried to pick players who are iconic in one way or another. And it's sort of richly ironic that the goalkeeper, Jim Sanders, will always be remembered for an attack of nerves. On May 1st, 1954, West Brom were trailing 2-1 to Preston in the FA Cup final and got a penalty. And that led to perhaps one of the most famous photographs in all football history. It's of the full length of the Wembley pitch, taken from the one end, looking towards Ronnie Allen striking the ball. But closest to the camera, there's Jim Sanders, the goalkeeper, clutching the post, looking the other way, can't bear to watch any of the action. And if you only knew Sanders from that picture, you'd think he was the highly strung type, prone to attacks of the vapours. But that couldn't be further from the truth. He started his career at Charlton in 1939, and then rather more important matters came to the fore, and he joined the RAF for the Second World War. He made 120 flights as a gunner before he was seriously injured on an operational flight, which led him to be invalided out of the services. And his injuries were so severe to his neck and to his back that he seemingly would never play again. Except he did, because he decided he was going to become a centre-forward. And he scored 50 goals in the season for Charlton in the reserves before deciding now he was going to stick to goalkeeping instead. Went back to playing in goal, and then moved to the Albion in November 1945. And basically from there, exchanged the place with Norman Heath in goal. Ironically, Sanders was out of the team in 53-54 until Albion played at Sunderland about 6 weeks from the end of the season, at which point Norman Heath, diving at somebody's feet, got a kick to the neck and never played again. Sanders was put back into the team and went on and won the cup with Albion in that game in 54. But I think it sums up what the FA Cup is, how much it means, the significance of the final, what it represents in a player's career. That a fella who'd been in the RAF in World War II, 120 bombing missions, a rear gunner at the sharp end, opposite the sharp end of the plane, but the end of the plane where they were most likely to get it. Went through all of that, went through injuries that could have finished his career, and still when a penalty was taken, the one thing that he couldn't do was look at a penalty being taken. That's the FA Cup for you.
And, as I said, Dave, when I saw this name crop up, I thought, ooh. When I looked up the story, I thought, well, I mean, how have I never heard of this guy before? But I thought, I won't sort of delve too deep because I want to hear the Dave Bowler pitch because it's going to be brilliant. And, of course, it was. Another great left field selection, Dave, been brilliant. Stevie, I'm going to come to you next, buddy. Now, we've had two different but sort of a similar era descriptions of a goalkeeper. Yours is a little bit more, well, not totally up to date, but a little more contemporary, a little less Second World War, shall we say. Stevie, away you go.
Yeah, my goalkeeper straddles the black and white and coloured eras. I've gone for the man with the shovels for hands, Pat Jennings, the man who could be, I don't know, he could be a cartoon character in Viz. An arch enemy of Billy the Fish, Pat the Shovel. Pat the Shovels with his massive hands. It's that crossing of the divide to win the FA Cup in a Tottenham shirt and then go and do it at Arsenal after being, shown the door by Tottenham. He wanted to stay. The directors weren't for it. They didn't even have the dignity to give him a significant farewell at Tottenham. He walked across the car park at White Hart Lane. They literally ignored him as he got into his car. Many clubs were interested in Pat Jennings, and he had the balls to say, "I'm going to stick in North London. I'm going to go to Arsenal of all teams," because he didn't want to move his family. He was happy where he was. His kids were settled. He's been ditched by Tottenham. Why shouldn't he walk across over to Islington and join Arsenal? He subsequently went on to reach three successive FA Cup finals with, winning probably what was meant to be the most difficult of the three, in defeating Manchester United in dramatic circumstances, having bookended that with, I think, two of the most iconic FA Cup final defeats against Ipswich Town and West Ham United. Winner with Tottenham in 1967, 13 years separate his first and last FA Cup final on a playing basis. Yet there was another facet to Pat Jennings in the FA Cup when Neville Southall picked up a serious leg injury, serious break on duty for Wales in the 85-86 season. It brought Bobby Mims into play. And with very little in the way of experienced cover for a goalkeeper who wasn't particularly experienced himself, Fred Barber, the rubber-faced man, was the next in line. Howard Kendall turned to Pat Jennings to come in as cover. And he went to the 1986 final, the World Cup finals, as an Everton player. There's plenty of pictures of him at Wembley that day in an Everton blazer. Any mishap in the days prior to the 1986 FA Cup final for Bobby Mims, it would have been Pat Jennings playing at Wembley that day. He'd left Arsenal, ironically, to go back to Tottenham in 85, played a Screen Sports Super Cup game in a Tottenham shirt again. Pat Jennings, is from winning it with Tottenham in 67 to three finals in succession with Arsenal to his association with Everton 86. He's the man of FA Cup finals, rivaled only by Ray Clements, I would say.
Guys, I don't know if you can see this clock here, but it says 2 minutes 59.56 seconds. Steve, I don't know if you're timing it, mate, but if you are, you probably nailed that brilliantly. That's terrific. Okay, guys, so, okay, give me some thinking time. I want to hear what you think about the other two selections rather than your own guy. So, Aidan, coming to you first. You've got a guy fairly contemporary to your selection, Jim Sanders, and the story that Dave told, and then perhaps more well-known, Pat Jennings. What do you think, mate?
Well, Jim Sanders seemed to have an impressive military background, just like Bert Trautmann, but Jim Sanders never won the Iron Cross, did he? So, you know, that's
I thought he was on the right side, you see.
But does that make the story more dramatic? I don't know on that one. Obviously, I also knew nothing about him, so it was really, really interesting to hear about and really fascinating. And obviously, Dave's love for all things FA Cup is well known, so it's a nice little way to tell that. Equally, Pat Jennings, yes, I mean, it's quite something to win it with two rival clubs, so that's probably more familiar. So I'd veer towards that, but I'm hesitating in it because Dave's pitch was pretty good.
Yeah, he does that, doesn't he? Picks these guys and it was brilliantly. Dave, okay, so put your guy back into the unknown area where it was before we heard your brilliant pitch. Trautmann and Jennings, obviously two vastly different eras and different goalkeepers' thoughts.
This is really tricky because, I mean, I had Bert Trautmann as one of my choices.
You did.
And I was very close to going for him, which I wouldn't have got anyway, obviously. So, yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic story, isn't it? Again, that's real FA Cup lore. But Pat Jennings was one of my favourite players as a kid. I remember having bought for me the Pat Jennings goalkeeping gloves, which were basically a pair of gloves that were green. So he was a big hero. But, I mean, I think you've got to give it Bert Trautmann, you know. I mean, Pat Jennings never broke his neck, to be fair. And that's a good thing.
I mean, yeah, Stevie, you know, your guy never broke his neck and never got sort of shot at on a bombing raid as well, but which, you know, is perhaps something not to condemn the guy for, but, you know, if we put your guy to one side...
He grew up in Newry. I think it was quite incendiary.
Fair comment, buddy. But we've got Trautmann and Jim Sanders, too, of a similar era. I mean, obviously, in this conversation, we have lots of players skimming different eras, but this is two fairly, not exactly the same era, but pretty well the same. Thoughts on those two guys?
I knew of Jim Sanders. I didn't know the full story. I knew of him because of that fascination I've got with Vic Buckingham. So, you know, I know a lot about his 1954 FA Cup winning team. And yeah, you know, great story that Dave's, I know, enlivened. He's filled out there for us. We've learned something tonight, very much so. And he's told the story so well that he's running Bert Trautmann very, very close in which way I would sway there, which seems absolutely insane because, you know, come on, it's Bert Trautmann. You know, he played on with a broken neck. What was that program that Jack D used to be in? It was like a bit of a kind of like a comedy drama thing where he was a PE teacher and he gets hit by a javelin and he says, no, it's okay, I'll run it off. And you know, there's a heavy degree of Bert Trautmann to that. So you've broke your neck. It's fine, I'll run it off. It'll be fine. You know, it's kind of like it's Jerry Byrne on acid. You know, broken with the broken collarbone in 65 and all that type of stuff. But yeah, so by a far narrower margin than anyone could have expected it to be, I'd have to just sway with Bertrand.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, having listened to the sort of arguments, and it's interesting to note that Hayden had Bertrand as his first choice, both Dave and Stephen had Bertrand as their second choice. Jim Saunders, you know, coming up on the rails from nowhere. I mean, yeah, so class. I think I've got to go Bert Trautmann because of the story that grew up around it. And I want to put the Iron Cross to one side and perhaps he might be dazed and confused and Led Zeppelin will write another song about him in the future. But, oh, yeah, I've got to go with Bert Trautmann. That was great. That's a great discussion. And, you know, I mean, I sort of fairly dismissed Pat Jennings really quickly there, but which was harsh. But I think the story around Trautmann sways it. So I'm going to give it to Bert Trautmann on the goalkeeper. Right, so we're moving out of the penalty area into the defence. And Dave, I'm going to come to you first. Are you going to pick a name out of somewhere that nobody's ever heard of again, buddy? Of course you are.
Well, given that we're covering the whole of the FA Cup, I thought we should go back to 1872. And Major Francis Merindon who's the archetypal Victorian Renaissance man. Michael Palin, you know, made a ripping yarns about him, basically. I mean, he was Eton educated. He joined the Royal Engineers in 1854. He saw service in the Crimea, working in the same hospital as Florence Nightingale. He got a knighthood later on in life for being the brains behind installing electric light in London. And apart from that, he had time to play a bit of football as well. He was credited as one of the sort of founding fathers of the Royal Engineers football team. They were said to be the first to exploit the passing game in English football. A big figure in that, not just in the team, but within the organisation itself. They got to the first FA Cup final, of course, in 1872, losing to the Wanderers. Merindon played at fullback in that one. They lost again in 1874 against Oxford University, played again. 1875, the Royal Engineers carried off the cup. Unfortunately, the major, Francis Merindon, he wasn't playing because they were playing Old Etonians. And given that he was an Old Etonian himself, he decided he couldn't play against his old team, which is, you know, taking the not celebrating thing a bit too far, I think. But he refused to play, and of course they won the cup. Apart from playing, he was the president of the Football Association from 1874 to 1890. And he was, being a right clever dick, he was also a referee and said to be the man with the best knowledge of the laws in the game. He refereed the cup final in 1880, and then he did seven in a row, 1884 to 1890. My favourite of these, and I do apologise, there will be no more West Bromwich Albion references beyond this. But in 1888, the Albion played Preston, who were just about to become the Invincibles the following year. And Preston got to the cup final, and they were in a hurry to leave after the game. They went to him and said, could we possibly be photographed with the cup before the game? Because they were so confident they were going to win. And he said to him, don't you think you better win it first? For which, you know, he has always had my eternal support. Not only that, at the end of the game, after Albion had won, bizarrely, he went into the dressing room and said, is it true that you're all Englishmen? In fact, they were all from within about 10 miles of West Bromwich. Once he'd heard that they were all Englishmen, he allowed them, because he was allowed to keep the ball as a referee, but learning that they were all Englishmen, he decided that he was going to give it to the Albion to keep. Of course, we lost the bloody thing since. There we go.
There you go, indeed. There you go. A typical dive bowler picks there. There's again a name I hadn't heard of, and I didn't want to look at too much about it because I want to hear Dave's pitching delivered brilliantly. I mean, what a guy, in fairness. I mean, if he knows all the laws of the game, probably could do with him now. I don't know about some of the clowns who've got refereeing games now, but there you go. Stevie, going to come to you next, and I think you've sort of dipped back into history as well for your guy, mate. Where you go?
Yeah, I've gone for a near contemporary by the name of Arthur Kinnaird, Lord Arthur Kinnaird. 9 FA Cup finals this individual played in. You know, he covered every position on the pitch. He played in goal, he played in defence, he played in midfield, he played up front. You know, a jack of all trades and a tough one at that. When playing in goal in the 1877 FA Cup final, he reputedly scored an own goal. He had the ball in his hands, took a step back, which took himself over the goal line. To give Oxford University a goal that was actually kind of scrubbed from history for the best part of 100 years. You know, there was a cover-up at play. I don't know whether to save his blushes or not, but the goal was kind of expunged from the record books until it was dug up again in the 1980s via, you know, the advent of contemporary archives being more accessible. So this goal was eventually reinstated, but it just added more luster to his reputation. You know, he scored in finals, he mastered midfield, but in defence, you know, he was known as the toughest tackler of his day. Very, very fond of the concept of hacking. You know, he'd have been well at home in the 1988 Wimbledon side in that respect. A full lustrous beard. A man who looked like he was, you know, physically, you know, visually, he looked like he should be able to walk off the pitches of the FA Cup final and straight onto the fields of Lords to take on the Australians in the Ashes. You know, beyond that, you know, he could have been playing guitar with C6 Steve or ZZ Top. You know, he would have blended into any landscape. As I say, he played in 9 finals. He was on the winning side 5 times. He was a win of Wanderers and the Old Etonians. One of his victories, the FA Cup final, he celebrated in front of the pavilion, standing on his head. A touch of the Bruce Grobblers about him. Clearly an eccentric, you know, scorer of ludicrous own goals, a hacker of opposing strikers, a goal scorer of repute. He was a man who absolutely had everything in his armoury. You know, along with his I don't know, physical aspects of this was something in which, you know, his wife, you know, had nightmares about the prospect of him coming back from games with a broken leg. She had a concept of him coming back with a broken leg. A teammate said,
Time, matey.
I've got to put this in, though. His teammate turned around and said, "Worry not, madam. If he does return with a broken leg, it won't be his own."
Shades of, was it Redknapp said that about Stuart Pearce? He rang Stuart Pearce's wife up and said, "I'm sorry to say Stuart's coming home with a broken leg." And his wife said, "Whose is it?" Yeah, classic. I mean, the Grobbelaar of the 19th century there, Steve, doing handstands in front of the pavilion after winning the FA Cup. So, yeah, we'll gloss over the own goal a bit. So, Aidan, we've got basically there defenders. And by the way, Lord Arthur Kinnaird is the guy who was also featured as a forward in the list selection. This is the guy, but as Steve said, and I looked up, it's true, he did play almost every position on the park. So it would be harsh not to let him be selected. Aidan, having heard two selections going back to the 19th century, you're a little bit more up to date with yours, and away you go, buddy.
I am more up to date, and no player in that whole 153 years of FA Cup history has won it as many times as this player, and that's Ashley Cole. 7 wins coming at 2 different London clubs in an era spanning a decade. I guess perhaps he was fortunate that his peak years coincided with an era where few of the big clubs were dominating the trophy, but, you know, that would be a little bit to downplay his significance in the Arsenal and Chelsea teams that he played in and the contribution he made to those victories. So the first of those came in 2002 against his future club Chelsea, and then they won again the year after, as Arsenal that is, beating Southampton, with Cole clearing a last gasp James Beattie header off the line deep into stoppage time to secure that win. Then 2005, the next one, they were there again. This time, Cole playing a crucial role in a determined defensive performance from Arsenal as they held the attacking talents of Manchester United. This is Rooney, Ronaldo, Van Nistelrooy et al. Held them at bay despite not showing too much in attack themselves. So it's one of the many big occasions, I guess, in which Ashley Cole stifled the skills of young Cristiano. He then scored in the resulting penalty shootout as Arsenal won. That one in particular came in the midst of various claims of tapping up by Chelsea and of Cole's complicity in that. Took another year or so. I don't worry, Gary, they don't have to be all upset. It took another year before Chelsea got a hold of him. And he was soon off, though, to the mega wealth of West London. But the winning just carried on. He came back from injury late in that season to feature as a sub in Chelsea's win over Manchester United again in 2007. Then he was man of the match 2 years later in the 2009 Cup final win over Everton. Another magnificent display from him. Now, this made him the first player since the 19th century to win it 5 times. That is Lord Kinnaird, as we've just been hearing about. But Ashley Cole went better than that, didn't he? Not only was he definitely a defender, but he won it several more times. A year later, set a new record, winning his 6th in 2010 against Portsmouth. And then 2 years later, his 7th with victory over Liverpool. That's 7 FA Cup wins, 2 different clubs, in the midst of a glittering career for one of England's finest ever players, and someone who was a cornerstone of every team he played in, crucial to every bit of their success. He is a true FA Cup legend, as yet unsurpassed. But I'll leave you with one final oddity. His only proper goal in the competition, save for that penalty shootout goal he scored in 2005, it wasn't for either Arsenal or Chelsea. But it came in a 2-1 defeat for Derby County at Brighton in the 2019 fifth round. That was his final match in the competition, his 49th FA Cup match in all. But his 7 wins, though, keep him 2 ahead of the next best still, and I think it's a record he will keep for some time. The FA Cup's greatest.
Well, okay, it's time to look at the clock again, guys. Aidan, you went 800ths of a second over.
That was your delayed reaction, Gary.
It was my delayed.
I'll be held accountable for that.
Pressing the button. Right. Okay. I mean, Ashley Cole's time is better than mine, that's for sure. Dave, I'm going to come to you first with a little bit of help here. So we've got to dipping back into the history with Steve here, and more up to date one with Ashley Cole and Aidan. Thoughts, buddy? It's difficult to compare across centuries, isn't it? I mean, literally set a century.
Having chosen the pair of them as second choices, I think.
You did.
I mean, it is very difficult to. I mean, obviously, Lord Kinnaird, I mean, you know, he's got all the pedigree of the FA Cup, and they ended up giving him the trophy, didn't they? Ultimately, for his services to the competition. But I'm glad Aidan's gone with Ashley Cole, because, I mean, Ashley Cole is a very difficult person to warm to, you know, with all of the things that have gone on with Ashley Cole's life. But, he is one of the best players I've seen in the last 25 years. He's a fantastic footballer. He's almost as good as Derek Stathen. That's how good he is. So it is incredibly difficult to choose between the pair. But anybody got a coin? We could. I don't know. I'm going to go for Lord Kinnaird just because he looks a bit like WG Grace. But really, there's nothing between them. Absolutely nothing.
Okay. Before I come to you, Steve, it's worth mentioning that Ashley Cole, aside from Bert Trautman, was the only guy that was selected by all three of you in different sorts of priorities. But put your guy to one side for a second, Stevie, his lordship and his own goal. Let's talk about the other two selections. What are your thoughts?
Again, with Dave on this, it's a hair's breadth between the two. You know, you've got Major Mandarin there who, you know, he's the type of person that the FA Cup was built upon. He's, you know, it's, you know, without people like that, then, you know, Ashley Cole doesn't get the chance to do what he does 100 odd years later. Yet, Ashley Cole, you know, what he did there in the success that he had in the competition, he clearly had a relish for in an era in which the competition was, you know, already diminished in the eyes of many, you know, on a playing field that isn't quite as level as it used to be, perhaps, you could argue. But to do what he did with a talented Arsenal side and then to go and do it with Chelsea as well is very impressive too. And I think it is just that foundation building that makes me lean towards Major Mandarin in that respect. Like you said, we all put Ashley Cole in. And I did come massively close to putting Ashley Cole as my first pick for this. And it was basically on the basis that Kinnaird had scored this ludicrous own goal. And he'd celebrated victory by standing on his head. I think if Ashley Cole had a similar kind of celebration to winning, say, is the last of those FA Cups, then that probably would have been the clinching aspect.
If he'd scored a spectacular own goal in the last of his FA Cup finals, that would have been for Liverpool.
That would have been
purely coincidentally.
I would have approved of that as well. I would have approved of that one as well. I'm going to have to go with Major Mandarin. And if he doesn't win this face-off, which is a tough one to call here, then he has to be the honorary referee for the piece.
It's a good call. Aidan, I guess your sort of comparison is a little bit easier because, obviously two lesser well-known characters than the guy you selected, but we're talking this similar era here. So Lord Kinnaird or Major Arthur Mandarin?
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily easier. It's very, very hard. I'm not sure how much help I'm going to be here. If you'd asked me to think of a name of somebody associated with the FA Cup in the 19th century, the only name I would have been able to give you is Lord Kinnaird, from knowing the sort of pivotal role he played in the early days of that competition and then, you know, obviously becoming part of the FA and all that shebang. I didn't know much about the other guy. Again, Dave has given me something I did not know before. And he seems so utterly synonymous with it all as well. So I'm not going to be any help to you at all here, Gary. I cannot pick.
I mean, that's fair enough, yeah. As I mentioned earlier, you know, when I saw there's a few unusual names, I didn't want to delve too deep because I wanted to hear what the guy's pitch was. So, I mean, this is probably the most difficult selection because Ashley Cole in the modern era is far and away the best choice, clear choice, because of his record in the FA Cup. I just think because of the history of the competition, if you go back to 1872, it would be wrong to ignore some of the pioneers. And I think I'm going to go with Francis Marindin because, you know, of his sort of playing record and also a referee, and the fact that perhaps Lord Kinnaird put an own goal and then did a handstand, perhaps not the best way to sort of apologise for the own goal. So I'm going to go with Major Francis Marindin. Dave's persuasive pitch again for somebody I've never heard of. Swung this one. Okay, we're going to move into midfield now. So, Stevie, I'm going to come to you first. Let me just get the clock ready, and you can start whenever you're ready. Go!
I'm going to go for a midfielder who is probably responsible for the last truly iconic FA Cup third round moment. I'm going for Matthew Hanlon of Sutton United. Part-time bricklayer, self-employed part-time bricklayer. It's Coventry City. It's the team that have won the FA Cup not much more than a year and a half earlier. You know, there's no way in the world that this team of John Sillett's in this, you know, magnificent kit, you know, with the, you know, first division reputation of, you know, FA Cup winners, perennial Houdini artists, at least once every 3 years, escaping relegation, but, you know, a purveyor of some of the most esoteric and finest kits across decades and all of that. It's the classic upset. It's the classic upset. This is, you know, it's sorry, Aidan, but it's Hereford. It's the Hereford of the 1980s. And here comes Matthew Hanlon, drifted in from the left-hand side to get on the end of that cross, you know, edge of the six-yard box. And it's everything that surrounds this goal. It's the lunacy and the bedlam that goes off in the stands. It's the windmill celebration that speaks to the 1970s almost. You know, this is, you know, and again, it's John Motson, you know, doing that commentary just as it was at Edgar Street all those years earlier. Sorry, Aidan. For me, this is, I don't know, kind of like the watermark of the FA Cup. You know, there's horrors to come at the end of this season with the FA Cup and the Hillsborough disaster. And this is kind of like the end of innocence for the FA Cup for me. And this is just kind of like the, I don't know, it's the full stop in what the FA Cup used to be. And it becomes a very different entity after this. You know, they got past Dagenham Aylesbury and you know, into the fourth round, they'll get beat by Norwich 8-0. But, you know, on Monday, he has to kind of like go back to work, do some bricklaying, but bail out at 12 o'clock because he's a guest on Wogan. And for the next 3 weeks, he's inundated with media requests that strangely dry up after Carrow Road. But for that split second and his manager on the pitch and all of that, you know, this was, I say, the last hurrah of romance for the FA Cup. And it has to be Matthew Hanlon.
I mean, great pitch. Great, great pitch, Steve. It's interesting, all three choices in this section scored iconic goals. And Matthew Hanlon, I remember the game so well. That's great. It's great pitch. And I like the Wogan reference at the end as well, but adding a little bit of colour to it. Aidan, I'm going to come to you next. Another iconic goal. Where you go?
Well, has there ever been a better, more iconic FA Cup winning goal than that scored by Ricardo Villa, or Ricky Villa to you and me, in the 1981 Cup final replay? Of course not. The wandering zigzags that he did on his way to glory there. It's repeated in all great FA Cup moment montages for a reason, and it's because it remains the most iconic of all the winning goals through the years. It was even voted Wembley's goal of the century, and who am I to argue with that? He'd arrived at Spurs with Ardiles, of course, following Argentina's win in the 78 World Cup, getting a nice Buenos Aires-style ticker tape welcome to boot, scored on his Tottenham debut as well, but it's only this goal in 81 that he gets remembered for forever. He'd not actually had a good time of things in the initial final against Manchester City, this was 1981. He was on the right side of their midfield, but he'd struggled in the game, didn't really get much authority on it, and was withdrawn midway through the second half while Spurs were still trailing. Pretty much distraught by all accounts at this turn of events, but 5 days later, things would turn around somewhat. He had kept his place in the starting lineup for the replay. It was a wet Thursday evening back at Wembley. He even scored the opening goal. Now, who remembers that? He scored the opening goal of the game, rather less iconic style than what was to come. Basically being at the right place at the right time to tap one home past Joe Corrigan, the ball falling nicely to him. But this was just the dress rehearsal as he'd run off for one goal celebration. Better was to follow. So with the match tied at 2-2 in the closing minutes, he picked up the ball well outside the city box, ran at the bunch of four or five defenders who seemed poised to stop him, but mostly fell over or stumbled as he sort of jinked his way through, changing direction again, sending them flying in his wake, and then sliding the ball past Joe Corrigan and one of the stumbling defenders, and sending the crowd into uproar and a very high-pitched piece of another excitable commentary from John Motson. He ran off again this time, but you know it felt utterly different to his first goal. This goal was so good that it just felt decisive on the match. Great goals at the right moment can inflict more damage than merely adding one to the scoreline. They can deflate and defeat the opposition. And that's what happened on this day with this goal, the greatest goal in FA Cup final history. He may not have been the greatest midfielder of all time. He wasn't Tottenham's greatest of the era, and he wasn't even the best Argentinian import in that side. But he was a very good player who produced a moment of pure brilliance on a huge stage. And that's the stuff of sporting greatness. And I guess if you're going to be remembered for one moment, one great moment to stand above everything else you did, you may as well make it so utterly iconic that nobody ever forgets it. And that's what he did that day.
258.94. Yeah, great pitch as well, buddy. Yeah, I remember an iconic goal. As Wembley finals go, it's an iconic goal, as you say.
I managed to avoid mentioning Garth Crook's little leg jink to try to finish it for him.
It's probably as well. Garth would have hung his head in shame if he nicked that one on the goal line, wouldn't he, really? I mean, that's the Ronaldo sort of, Cristiano Ronaldo sort of finish, isn't it? You know, nicking somebody's goal and tapping in from the 3 inches away. Dave, you've given us some left field selections. This is sort of more famous, your guy here. The way you go, buddy.
Aidan, I'd just like to say I'm very, very sorry and invite you to take your headphones out for 3 minutes. It is, of course, Ronnie Radford. Ricky Villa may have scored the greatest goal in FA Cup final history. The greatest goal in FA Cup history. Without any shadow of a doubt, you may shake your head, but it is Ronnie Radford in the what I think many people have called the greatest FA Cup tie of all time. And while I understand your pain, in the bigger picture, let's remember, Malcolm McDonald lost. So that's a good thing for us all, surely. I mean, it is the greatest goal of all time in the FA Cup, in the greatest period in the FA Cup's history. You know, Hereford United, go to St James's Park, get a draw, bring them back to Edgar Street. And it's just, I mean, the game gets called off twice. And again, I do apologise, Aidan, but the majesty of this is the replay finally happens on FA Cup fourth round day, which means it's on a Saturday, which means it's on match of the day, which it wouldn't have been in any other time. And, you know, Malcolm McDonald scores and Newcastle look like they're going to win it. And there we are, just in the dying seconds. Ronnie Radford on Hereford High Street wins the ball off John Tudor, plays a quick 1-2 and then laces it into the top corner. Ian McFaul, God bless him, makes it look fantastic with his diving effort to try and save it. It's nobody saving that. It flies into the top corner. John Motson goes berserk and gets himself a career for the rest of his life. And there's a glorious picture from behind Ronnie Radford of the cathedral in the background, you know, and the Mappa Mundi is in that cathedral. But this is a greater miracle than the Mappa Mundi. Ronnie Radford's goal is everything that the FA Cup is about. There's no question about it. I mean, this obviously when Gary chooses the wrong one, this is going to be my platina for the rest of every TFT podcast that we ever do. But, you know, I could just have said at the start of this, Ronnie Radford, and that would have been it, because everybody in the world would have known why this is the correct answer. I rest my case with 40-odd seconds left to go. Just to spare you the pain, just for you.
Oh, you're so gracious.
Dave, you're all hard. You stabbed him in the back, in the front, and in the neck, and then you said, so sorry, mate. I mean, yeah, okay. I mean, you know, nobody picked Bazaglio's goals against the Baggies, Dave, so you were okay there. And, you know, all our clubs have sort of FA Cup sort of trials and tribulations of the past, but yeah, iconic moment. Stevie, putting your guy to one side for a moment, Ricky Villa, Ronnie Radford, what do you think, buddy?
Both utterly iconic moments, utterly iconic. You know, this the Ronnie Radford goal, it's football's equivalent of when Harold Graham gets hit by that swinging punch that just sees him drop like a tree. That's what it is in footballing terms. But then you've also got this Ricky Villa goal, which is kind of like it became the soundtrack. It became a stereotype almost for the FA Cup. You know, it was shown that often that, you know, it kind of almost went out of fashion, but to come back in. A bit like the Tardelli goal in the 82 World Cup final. We saw it so many times, you almost became desensitised to it. But then you start to view it in so many different ways, which inclusive of that Garth Crooks hook of the foot to will him on to put that ball in the back of the net. Obviously, as an 80s kid, you know, that was a huge thing. But obviously, the Ronnie Radford goal as well. The two of these moments ended up on the montages for Match of the Day for decades and decades and decades. And, you know, we will never outrun these. These will outlive us all for hundreds of years beyond our existences. Honestly, I think I'm with Aidan earlier on. I find this impossible to split. This is an atom. This is an atom, a footballing atom that is impossible to split, which is why you have to pick Matthew Anlam, basically.
Oh, neatly done, Stephen. Neatly done as ever. Aidan, so I want to ask you to compare Matthew Anlam and Matthew Anlam. I know we spoke about the Ronnie Radford thing before, so, you know, whatever you think, buddy.
I mean, if you think I'm voting in favour of Ronnie Radford, you're very much mistaken. You know, he is on a list in mine and other Newcastle fans' minds, along with Cantona, Mike Ashley and Graham Sodding Fenton. You know, this is what we're talking about here. He just got lucky, didn't he? You know, the ball's bobbling all over. He just swings a leg and, oh, just happens to go in. You know, that's as lucky as they come, honestly. He's been living off this for 50-odd years for just getting lucky. If he was any good, he'd have played for somebody else. It was just pure luck. Anyway, with that in mind, I'm voting for Matthew Hammond.
Well, a reasoned argument and logic deployed in all cases there. Well done, mate. Yeah,
in all seriousness, just to add to that, you know, Newcastle's moments in FA Cup glory are so dim and distant that this is the moment we get remembered for in FA Cup. And it is irritating, but you do understand the reason for it, but I'm still not voting for it.
Fair enough, buddy. I would have been disappointed if you had, mate. So, Dave, what do you think? Matthew Hanlon, the brickie who broke the heart of Coventry City, or the Argentine guy who danced around Man City and rolled the ball into the new bag to win the FA Cup?
I might have touched a nerve there. I don't know.
No. No.
I think
it still wasn't as much vitriol as Gary got for the Panenka decision.
I think in the end, I have to go for Ricky Villa. I mean, it is just such a fantastic goal. And it's, you know, it's got the benefit of that redemption story, hasn't it, over the 4 days, you know, him trooping off disconsolate on the Saturday after he'd been substituted and then coming back and lighting up the cup final with this goal that, you know, probably is the greatest FA Cup final goal, I think. I mean, the brickie from Sutton, I mean, again, it's a great moment. It's not as good as Ronnie Radford. Probably Tim Bazzaglo is perhaps the last great third round shocker. Although Albion were absolutely crap at the time, so it probably wasn't such a shock. But no, it's Ricky Villa.
Okay. I think if I don't have an FA Cup upset goal, it's just not doing just the FA Cup. And while I recognise the talent of Ricky Villa, it's a great goal. Yeah. I mean, he was a talented guy. I think sometimes it's important that, you know, we recognise the glory of the FA Cup, what it suggests. And, you know, both Steve and Dave made great pitches for their guys. So I'm going to go one of them. I like the pitch, Dave, that, you know, it was a better goal than the map, more important of a miracle than the Map of Monday. That's great. And I think one of the enduring images of that goal was McFall, the goalkeeper, almost hovering in the air for a second as a ball flew past him. Matthew Hanlon was, there again, another great story, Stevie. You're going to hate my guts, and I'm sorry, buddy, but I've got to go with Ronnie Radford. It's just the most iconic FA Cup upset goal of all time, I think. Yes, he was lucky. Yes, the pitch was crap. Yes, it was muddy. Yes, it was pouring down a rain. It was horrible. And it was just, I'm going to close my eyes and smack it through. But I think that's what the FA Cup's all about, the glory, the knockouts, the cup upsets. So I'm going with Ronnie Radford, and sorry, not sorry.
Well, there's just two of us left for the rest of this programme then.
Pure cliched nonsense.
Moving swiftly along,
I'd just like to add it was Julian Jackson that knocked Harold Graham over there just to distract Aidan for a minute.
Thanks, Stevie.
YouTube Claxton, if you've never seen that knockout.
Oh, right, it's a bit of a stunner. You don't get up from them, that's for sure. Aidan, so I hope you're going to forgive me for a moment and we're going to come into the forward line. I know you're not going to.
I saw it all coming. Don't worry. I saw it all coming.
You can't be Platini, but tell me your forwardies, buddy. Away you go.
Okay. Well, we're going to go into cliched nonsense here again. So, what is the 1953 FA Cup final known as? The Matthews final. Pure sycophantic nonsense based on a bizarre collective wish to see this so-called Wizard of the Wing pick up a cup winner's medal. Now, he may have earned his place as the eponymous hero of this match, but he was not the only Stanley doing great things that day for Blackpool. And some might say, like me, right here, right now, that Stan Mortensen was the one who should have taken the accolades from this game. Okay, I will concede that Matthews did set up several of Blackpool's goals with his impressively slow-paced wing play and his little slow jink and cross. But, who was it who scored a hat-trick to secure victory in this Matthews final? Well, it was the guy at the sharp end of Blackpool's play, not the superstar Matthews. Oh, no, it was the son of South Shields up here on Tyneside, Stanley Mortensen. He was an incredible striker, a prodigious scoring rate, ultimately finishing with 197 goals in just over 300 games for Blackpool. That included seven in their run to the 1948 Cup final. And he scored in every round that year, including a hat-trick in the semi-final win over Tottenham. And he did score again in the final, making him the first player to achieve that feat. But they lost that year to Manchester United. 51, they reached the final again. But they succumbed to the greatness of my second pick for this, which is Jackie Milburn, of course, in Newcastle United. Here he features again. But in 1953, they had the chance again. Now, they were up against Bolton, Nat Lofthouse and all, and he'd given Bolton the lead early on. Mortensen then equalised. And that shot, okay, it was deflected. And at the time, they may have said it was an own goal. But, sanity prevailed soon after. And it was a bit of a disservice to him anyway to not give him that. He was awarded it in the days afterwards, mainly when a news reporter just gave it to him. And that story soon simply became fact. And I think that just adds to it. Bolton were 3-1 up deep into the second half before, guess who? Stan Mortensen pulled a goal back. Then with 2 minutes left, he scored yet again with a fierce free kick to equalise. When Bill Perry then scored the winner 2 minutes later, it was hailed as a triumph for Stanley Matthews, but it was only possible thanks to Stan Mortensen. When he died in 1991, oddly, on the very day that Blackpool played their first match at Wembley since that 53 final, one wag was quoted in The Independent as saying of Mortensen's funeral that they'll probably call it the Matthews funeral. In 1953, he had become only the third player ever to score a hat-trick in a cup final, a stat which remains to this day. Nobody's achieved it since. And I give you Stan Mortensen, the real FA Cup hero of 1953.
I love the fact that he jammed in a couple of North East players there, buddy. Well done. Well done. Well done. Well done, mate. Well done. Well done. Well done. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, everybody calls it Matthews Farm, right? And it's interesting to say the Matthews funeral when he got buried. Ouch. Okay, Dave, coming to you next. Another left field selection, typical Dave Bowler selection here. I'm going to listen to this one intently. Away you go.
I think the magnificence of the FA Cup is that it's always, not always, but it's so often the journeyman and the guy who never ordinarily gets the headlines who grabs the story in the FA Cup. And I think, in the greatest FA Cup decade, the 1970s, nobody did that better than Alan Taylor at West Ham. He started the 1974-75 season at Rochdale in the 4th Division as a kid just coming through. And Rochdale played Marine in the first round of the FA Cup. and that went to a replay. They won. They played Tranmere in the second round of the FA Cup and got knocked out. Now, ordinarily, Alan Taylor would have been playing in those games, but he was injured. And come the end of December 1974, West Ham were looking for a forward, and they bought Alan Taylor. And he came down to London. It took him a while to settle, and he eventually got in the team really towards the back end of February. He played his first FA Cup tie at Highbury when West Ham went there for the fifth round. I mean, the pitch, you've got to go and look at it on YouTube. I mean, it looks like Wimbledon's pitch from a couple of days ago. I mean, it was absolutely. You didn't need a substitute. You needed a submarine. It was an unbelievable service. The first goal, the ball gets stuck in a hole. The Arsenal goalkeeper leaves it. Eventually, it gets knocked over to the back post, and there's Alan Taylor rushing into school. The second goal is a lovely pass from Trevor Brooking, just inside, and Taylor sort of gouges it out of the mud and fires it into the bottom corner. 2-0, West Ham beat Arsenal into the semi-final. They play Ipswich. First game's a draw. Second game, Stamford Bridge. Alan Taylor again. Ipswich scored in the first minute, but he equalised fairly soon after, ghosting in at the back post with a little header. Then there's a clearance that drops to him 18 yards out. Hits it first time into the bottom corner. 2-1, West Ham have won. Alan Taylor got two goals in round six, two goals in the semi-final. West Ham off to the FA Cup final to play Fulham. What happens? Billy Jennings takes a shot from distance. Peter Miller spills it. And there's Alan Taylor to mop it up and slam the ball through Miller's legs to make it 1-0 West Ham. A little bit later, Graham Paddon drives one into the near post. Peter Miller obligingly spills it again into Alan Taylor's path. He scores again. West Ham win the cup 2-0. Alan Taylor, the fellow who started at Rochdale at the beginning of the season, has suddenly scored six goals in three FA Cup games. He's won the FA Cup for West Ham. And apart from the following season where he scored 17 goals and top scorer for West Ham, that's basically the end of his career. His entire career, really, is built on three FA Cup ties. Everybody who's a West Ham fan will always remember the name Alan Taylor, and that is the power of the FA Cup.
You know, it's interesting. When I saw Alan Taylor, I thought, this is going to be a difficult pitch. I didn't realise he scored goals in the semi-final and the sixth round as well. So, I mean, I looked at that, I thought, yeah, this is going to be a difficult pitch. But Dave, as typical, Dave Bowler delivered again. Good pitch, buddy, good pitch. Stevie, I'm going to come to you next. I mentioned at the start you only picked one, Anfield Red. But this is a good choice, buddy. Away you go.
I did. The only Liverpool player I threw into the equation for this one was the one and only Ian Rush. No man this side of 1888 has scored more goals in the competition. No man has scored more goals in FA Cup finals than this man. And it's not just about his time at Liverpool. He was part of a magnificent Chester run to the fifth round in 1979-80. You know, a run that... You know, went a long way in I don't know, drawing Liverpool's attention to this scrawny little teenager that hadn't even grown his tash yet. A run that took them all the way to Portman Road in the fifth round, where they narrowly lost out to Ipswich Town. A run in which, sorry, Aidan, they went to St James Park in the third round and knocked out Newcastle. This was, you know, part of his love affair with the FA Cup. Onwards to Liverpool, three times a winner. Two goals against Southampton in the 86 semi-final in extra time. The man for the big moment. Two goals against Everton in the 1986 final. Two goals again in the 1989 final, again against Everton. Picking on the perennial rivals, the team he supported as a kid. You know, he'd score again against Sunderland in much happier circumstances for Aidan in the 1992 final. it's that 1986 one. It's the second goal as well. It's the way that he plants it into Bobby Mims, you know, past his right hand. It nestles in that corner, and the camera set behind the goal bounces away. But it just remained an image that was shown again and again and again. You know, even after his Liverpool days, his very last FA Cup goal came in a Newcastle United shirt, Aidan, against Everton at Goodison Park. This was the you know, it was not the Ian Rush of old. You know, that Ian Rush had gone, but he still had the temerity to torment Everton. Sorry, Paul McParland. Over and over again, it had to be Everton on the punchline to his final say in the FA Cup. But you know, Ian Rush was the FA Cup throughout the 1980s and into the early 1990s. And I rest my case. There has to be no other man other than Ian Rush from Chester to Newcastle, with significant Liverpool in between. All those victories, all those goals. It's Ian Rush.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I thought this was a guy who didn't select you. Didn't let me down, Stevie. Okay, so let's give me a little bit of thinking time, Aidan. Put your selection to one side for a moment. Compare. I mean, Ian Rush and Alan Taylor, different stories, I suppose. There's one sort of, you know, supernova moment and one that sort of spread success over many years. Thoughts?
Well, again, Dave's pitch has made this a closer little decision or discussion than I thought it would. It's the stories that you don't know enough about that Dave is bringing to the table here, and that's really good stuff. Ian Rush, though, I think because his level of success has spanned so much further, I would probably go for him. I'm glad Stephen threw in his goal for Newcastle against Everton, because I was going to mention that here if he hadn't done so. Because he even came off the bench there. He was terrible for Newcastle, but he came off the bench briefly away at Everton, and of course he got the winner. But, you know, that probably doesn't count as one of his most important FA Cup goals. Mainly because I know much more about him, I would probably just veer towards him. But again, the fascinating story that Dave's told us there does make that a very, very close call. You're having a tough time here, Gary.
Yeah. As you quite rightly mentioned, say, when I saw Alan Taylor's name, I thought, well, I'll probably put that one to one side. But now Dave's delivered again. So, Dave, coming to you, two strikers, famous in the Northwest, Mortensen and Ian Rush. What do you think, mate?
This is a close one as well, but I mean, it's hard lines, isn't it? You score a hat-trick at Wembley and some other fool gets all the glory. I mean, you know, that's a bit unfair. And, you know, it just feels right that you get the chisel out and put Stan Mortensen up there, really, and he gets his due at last. I think that's fair. And also, you couldn't do the moustache either with the chisel, so, you know, Mortensen's the man.
I mean, in fairness, you don't know how much experience and practice I've had at chiseling difficult things. I had to do Henrik Larsson's dreadlocks years ago. So that was.
Didn't Panenka have a moustache?
Yes, he did. And I did. I made a great show of it as well. Yeah, mate. It's a very, very bushy one. It's just it's in Prague. If you ever go to Prague, have a look. It's just above, sits above the stadium where he used to play Bohemians. Yeah, Bohemians of Prague. Anyway, so Stevie. If you put Ian Rush to one side, two different things there, different eras and different types of player as well between Mortensen and Alan Taylor.
Yes, I mean, the Alan Taylor story is fantastic. You know, obviously I knew of Alan Taylor, you know, winning the Cup with West Ham and all that. But again, you know, like Dave's choice of goalkeeper, I didn't know the back story, you know, completely of him, and that was fascinating. But yeah, Stan Mortensen. You know, imagine that. You know, score a hat trick and it's you know, it's the Matthews final. That's like the Lakers calling the 2006 FA Cup final, the Cissé final, rather than the Gerrard final. Or you know, or it just seems so incredulous. You know, the story behind Stanley Matthews in that odyssey to win the competition and the will for people to see him win it. You know, it's great, but it is taking the piss that's not the Mortensen final, and I do have to start. I have to side with Stan in that respect.
It's interesting. It's like calling the 1996 World Cup final the Martin Peters final, isn't it? Really, Jeff Ernst gets the hat trick, and that's sort of thing. I mean, okay. Alan Taylor's a great story, but I think it's what sort of been a real tale for me. It's fleeting. It's one. It's iconic. I know. But I guess, you know, and they beat Fulham in the final. If they'd have beaten Man United or Liverpool or something, it might have been a different story. But I mean, a great pitch, Dave, as always. Picked a guy out of obscurity and put him right in the forward line. Mortensen and Rush. I think the guy who scored most goals in the FA Cup since 1888, I think Steve says, most FA Cup final goals since 1888, and also scored for Newcastle in the FA Cup.
No hat-tricks, though, in the final.
No, that's true. That's true. But won more finals. Won many more finals. So I'm going to go with Ian Rush. I think anything else would be a little sort of obtuse. I mean, Mortensen, you know, couldn't even get his own final named after him. I mean, you know, say Martin Peters in the World Cup final. But I think if I don't say Ian Rush, that would be unfair. So I'm going to go with Ian Rush there. So Steve, you got Liverpool guy in there.
It would have been sacrilege had it not been.
It would have been. He got your red shirt as well, but he said it would have been harsh not to give you one.
Okay. I'm taking this as you actually wanted Mortensen, but we're just naming it Ian Rush instead, you know, taking the glory.
It's the Ian Rush selection. That's right. I am correct, yeah. I like that. That's good, mate. We're crossing the white line and we're going to for managers, coaches, when we call them these days. Dave, I'm going to come to you first. And in typical Dave Bowler fashion, you picked a guy I don't know anything about. I looked him up a little bit, but I didn't want to look too much because I want you to give me a typical Dave Bowler pitch. Away you go, buddy.
I'm blurring the line slightly, but the greatest FA Cup manager, I think, is Jimmy Murphy from 1958. Technically wasn't the manager, I suppose, given that Matt Busby was a Manchester United manager. But in the wake of the Munich disaster on the 6th of February, Jimmy Murphy held Manchester United together completely. He only missed that flight because he was also the Wales manager at the time and he was on international duty while he was playing a World Cup qualifier. So he missed Munich, got back to Manchester only to find out that, you know, the plane had crashed, Manchester United had perished in the snow, and he was left to pick up the pieces and do what he could. And 13 days later, Manchester United played their first game, which was the FA Cup fifth round tie against Sheffield Wednesday. It's that famous game where the match programme's there and you look at where the teams are and there are no names for Manchester United because nobody knows who's going to play. And, you know, he's there cobbling together a team from youngsters and whatever and the transfer market. 59,000 people turn up at Old Trafford. And somehow Manchester United beat Sheffield Wednesday 3-0. Then in the sixth round, they go to West Brom. 58,000 at the Hawthorns. And it's a 2-2 draw. They get a late draw, Manchester United. They just keep going. And they win in front of 66,000 at Old Trafford in the replay. And Bobby Robson played for West Brom in that game. And he said there was no way on earth that Manchester United were not going to win that game. It didn't matter what we did. Manchester United were going to win because it was just such a tidal wave of emotion that carried them over. And then they play Fulham in the semi-final. Bobby Charlton scores twice in a 2-2 draw. And then they win 5-3. But you get to the final at Wembley, the Bolton final, they lose. But four of the survivors of Munich play in the final. But there's only two players left from the 1957 final. Six of them had died. Two of them would never play again. And somehow over those 3 months, Jimmy Murphy, as the acting manager, had stitched that club together, held them through, got them through. And if Manchester United hadn't got through that season, if Manchester United hadn't got to the cup final, what would the future of Manchester United be? But Murphy carrying everything with, you know, players that he'd brought up from being kids dead, with his mate Matt Busby in hospital, Duncan Edwards dying, somehow had the strength of character to pull that team through and get to the cup final. And whether they won it or not, it doesn't matter. That's the greatest manager in the FA Cup.
Dave, you're brilliant. Just brilliant, mate. Just brilliant. Yeah. I mean, a guy who sort of, you know, if you just look at the Cole records, he managed to, as acting manager, shall we say, for a losing cup final team. But a wonderful pitch, Dave, a wonderful pitch, typically brilliant. Stevie, you're going to beat that, brother. Away you go.
I fully agree. Great pitch there by Dave. I'm going for Bill Nicholson, the man of the 1960s as far as the FA Cup was concerned. a decade in which 8 different teams won the FA Cup, a decade in which only Tottenham won it more than once. 1961, it was part of them winning the League and FA Cup double, the first team of the 20th century to do so. In retaining the FA Cup in 1962, they were only the second team to do that in the 20th century. The other one being Newcastle United, Aidan. Some more Newcastle positivity there, as far as this podcast is concerned. And then to win it again in 1967, you know, in a London derby, you know, North versus West against Chelsea. Sorry, Gary. Bill Nicholson, you know, he's built these teams, you know, in a decade in which he leads Tottenham to be the first English club to win a European trophy. You know, this myriad of FA Cup success has so much going for it, because he builds kind of like 2 teams as well, you know, and even the first team has, by 1962, the addition of Jimmy Greaves to it, which is a blessing and a curse, because it kind of unsettles the double winning side. They never win a league title again to this very day. Yet there they are again in 67. You know, a rejuvenated side, inclusive of Pat Jennings, my choice of goalkeeper. And to be that omnipresent in the FA Cup during the 1960s, the most competitive decade this side of the Second World War, a decade in which 8 different teams won the league title as well. Success was massively spread around. So for any team to be able to do this was a stunning achievement. And to have such a historical context to it as well, that League and Cup double, that retaining of the FA Cup, which was so difficult to do, and then to rebuild and do it again and win the Cup again later in the decade. I think of all that era's great managers, you know, Bill Nicholson is, you know, probably along with Harry Kattrick, you know, from the north and the south, a juxtaposition of each other in not getting the kudos they should get. But in that respect, Nicholson was the FA Cup in managerial terms.
Okay, good call. Aidan, for your coach, we're just travelling the short distance from across North London from Tottenham to Arsenal, and tell us about your guy, buddy.
Yeah, we're coming a bit more recent again with this one. Now, Jose Mourinho once called Arsene Wenger a specialist in failure. Now, I know one or two things about sporting failure, as we've discussed at length. But while Wenger may not have won the league after 2004, his record of success in the FA Cup is, by any measure, simply astonishing. He is the competition's most successful manager, having won it no less than 7 times, parallel with Ashley Cole there. For context, that's 2 more FA Cup wins than any other manager, and indeed only 6 managers have ever won it more than twice. But given the longevity required for such an achievement, I think it's fairly safe to say it's a record unlikely to be beaten for a long time. His first came in 1998 against some team from the Northeast I can't quite recall, but they were very much outclassed on that day. He nearly added a second in 2001, only for Michael Owen to intervene late on in Cardiff. But that would be the only one that he would lose in terms of cup finals. A year later, they beat Chelsea 2-0, win again, and then Southampton in 2003 for a third title. And a fourth came in 2005 with that penalty shootout win over Manchester United. But that was all in his big successful era. This is when the so-called years of failure now kicked in. You know, the new wealth was dominating the trophies in England, and Arsenal were getting a bit left behind. And Wenger, who was an increasingly frustrated figure, I guess, as the glory dried up. And in those later seasons at Arsenal, you know, there was lots of growing discontent, rancor, and fans waving their little printed out pieces of A4 paper saying Wenger out. But he still only went and won the FA Cup another 3 times. 3 times in 4 seasons, that is, as well. And frankly, if it was me, and I like to think me and Arsene Wenger have so much in common, but if it was me, I'd have delivered the first of those last few trophies and then swanned off straight into the sunset, telling all the whingers to do one, frankly. But he's clearly made a sterner stuff. The 2014 final was the first of those. Now, the pressure was rather intense because it'd been 9 years without a trophy after all that glory they'd had. They were overwhelming favourites to beat Hull City, of course, but they made it rather difficult, winning out in extra time in the end. A year later, rather easier, they thrashed Villa 4-0 and then beat Chelsea a couple of years after that, 2-1, 2017. But it really, it's the remarkable longevity that can only be admired, I think. For all the other successes he brought Arsenal, it was the FA Cup where he actually brought by far the most joy, the most consistent victory. 7 victories, once a runner-up. He was 3 times a losing semi-finalist as well. So, you know, he had sustained success in this competition, but I still maintain he should have left after one of those last few victories and just told them all to F off.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. Dave, I'm going to come to you first and tell me if you can give me some guidance between the two North London managers that have been selected. What do you think, bud?
It's very difficult. I mean, I do want some kudos from Aidan for not picking Bob Stoker.
Oh, dearie me. I'm just glad nobody else did. Or that goalkeeper who just fell over and it happened to hit him.
I mean, this is really tough, isn't it? I mean, Arsene Wenger, he's the Ian Rush and the Ashley Cole in terms of management, isn't he? I mean, fantastic success. Bill Nicholson building that team through the 60s when it was such ferocious competition. I mean, I can't choose between. I mean, Nicholson's achievements are fantastic in the heat of that. But I've got a lot of time for what Wenger did at a time when everybody else was tossing the FA Cup off. You know, he always gave it a proper run. You know, yeah, it's. I can't pick between them, to be honest, Gary. I mean, it's a toss of a coin between them. That's how close it is.
You're not much help to me, Dave. I'm going to have to turn to Stevie for a bit of guidance. But it's worth mentioning, Aidan, before we go on, that that guy who fell over when he was in the goal, the ball hit him on the hand twice and he got up and hit him again, and was chosen by both of the guys for a third choice, so he didn't get in. Stoker wasn't picked at all, mate. So you were never in any danger, buddy.
Good. Glad to hear it.
But Stevie, I'm going to come to you then, matey. A difference between the two guys there, Arsene Wenger and the story of Jimmy Murphy. Thoughts, buddy?
I mean, what a record Arsene Wenger had. You know, was it nearly two decades between his first and his last FA Cup successes there? That is truly incredible. You know, absolutely amazing track record. No matter what condition the FA Cup was at various times throughout those years. And as part of that, I can still never quite see beyond him on the touchline at the Millennium Stadium in 2001, looking utterly disgruntled to his side as an incredulous Gerard Houllier is punching the air in one of the most amazing daylight robbery FA Cup finals in history. I was joyously there that day. So yeah, it's kind of bizarre to say, but Wenger's longevity and all that success, it does kind of like fall beneath the radar for me a little bit because of that gloriously sunny day in May 2001. Jimmy Murphy, you know, what a story, what a thing to do, what an achievement in dragging that Manchester United side to the 1958 final. So you know, two amazing choices there for differing reasons. And yeah, you know, I suppose with shades of Kenny Dalglish in 1989 in taking Liverpool to the 89 final after what had happened at Hillsborough. You know, I have that leaning towards Jimmy Murphy in that respect. You know, it's much more than just taking a team onto an FA Cup final. It's helping lift a city back up off its knees as well. And that's the difference here. In any other spectrum, I'd be going for Arsene Wenger without a shadow of a doubt. But I do have to go for Jimmy Murphy in that respect.
Okay, buddy. Okay. Aidan, it's coming to you to close it out now. So you've got a pick between Bill and Nick and Jimmy Murphy. Can you give me some help here?
Probably not, no. I think Bill Nicholson, big success. And I think there's parallels to Wenger just in a slightly shorter time frame and not with as many trophies. But the sort of two little stints of success with different teams that they had to develop. And I think there's similarities there. Whereas the Jimmy Murphy one, and yeah, that parallel to Dalglish is really good one. I think, both going on to the cup final in those respective seasons. That's a point I hadn't really thought of before, but it's a good one. But like with any sort of great tale of that, the victory or defeat, as it was in this case, doesn't necessarily matter. I think it's the fact that they picked themselves up and got there is just as important, and victory didn't really have to follow it. Whether Stephen would have felt the same in 1989 if Everton had won, I don't know. But, you know, that's a different matter. But I think, given the Bill Nicholson one has a lot of parallels to Wenger, just with not quite as much success, and the Jimmy Murphy one tugs on the heartstrings far more. And obviously, it was a club that was, you know, it could have fallen apart, as Dave said, and it was in the FA Cup where they actually were reborn in some ways. I think I'll go for that one.
Okay. You see, you've got me a really difficult situation here, guys. You know, if anybody says, you know, pick a first 25 managers in FA Cup history, I don't think I'd have put Jimmy Murphy in there. And after hearing Dave's pitch there, you think, well, why not? Why didn't you put him in there, you idiot? Because he should be in there. I think, you know, Bill Nicholson in the 60s, three FA Cup victories in the 60s when the trophies were spread about so much, unlike nowadays where, you know, there's three or four clubs seem to dominate trophies. I mean, the 60s was such a revolutionary era for different teams winning titles and FA Cup. So Bill Nicholson, that's a fairly exceptional success. I think the problem I have with Nicholson compared to Wenger is seven times, only lost one final. And it's difficult to see going forward anybody getting more than seven FA Cup final victories. I mean, you might have Guardiola if he stays there for the 5 years, but that's not going to happen. Oh, this is so difficult. I mean, I'm going to put Bill Nick to one side because I think compared to Wenger, he just sort of shared a little bit. I think I've got to go with Wenger. I think I've just got to go with Wenger just for the sheer volume of success. But Dave, you really got to stop giving me these difficult decisions when you pick these guys out of nowhere, do these brilliant pitches. I'm going to go with Wenger because I just think that the success he had over a long period of Stevenson across a decade or more, you know, it's ridiculous, and the success he had there. So I'm going to go with Wenger. So that's the FA Cup selections. So on the Mount Rushmore, these football times, Mount Rushmore FA Cup monument are Bear Troutman as the goalkeeper, Major Marin Dean as the defender, Ronnie Radford, a midfield player, Ian Rush, you're okay, Stevie, as the forward, and Arsene Wenger as the manager. So just like to say a massive thanks to the guys. You know, it's very easy for me to sit here and sort of pick the sort of best pitches, but, you know, these guys did all the research and the hard work. So massive thanks. Aidan, thanks to you, buddy, and I'm sorry you had a few Newcastle kicks in there. In the teeth, but you know,
this is what I come here for. I'm just a punching bag.
Yeah, come here for the debate, stay for the kicks. So, thanks, Aida. I hope it wasn't too bad.
All good. No, thoroughly enjoyed as usual.
Thanks, buddy. Dave, I mean, as always, mate, the left field selection just blow my mind sometimes, buddy. So, massive thanks to you, buddy, and your research and the way you approach these things, mate. It's joy as ever, buddy. Thank you.
I think what we've proved between the four of us is the FA Cup is the greatest competition in history, in any sport. Yeah, without a shadow over there.
No doubts, buddy. I mean, absolutely right. And Stevie, thanks, buddy. I mean, a massive thanks to you, buddy. And thank you for not going totally all red. And well done on Ian Rush, mate.
Oh, no problem. I'd say, even if you'd gone Stan Mortensen, I wouldn't have had any arguments whatsoever there. Like I said earlier on, you know, the FA Cup was for everyone to win rather than just Liverpool when I was a kid. You could have picked that. You could have just done it like a snow globe, and it could have been any selection of those. They were all fantastic nominations.
Yeah, true, Matty. I mean, much like so many things, that my selections are set in stone. I'm Mount Rushmore. But thanks, buddy. So now it's over to you, listeners. We'd love to hear some feedback from you, our audience. Did the guys make the good choices and convincing pitches for their selections? Who did we miss out? Stanley Matthews, perhaps. That should have been considered. And of course, did the judge make the right decisions? Of course I did. Seriously, though, it'd be great to hear from your thoughts on Twitter or X as you call these days, just tag at These Footy Times and hashtag TFTMRD for These Football Times Mount Rushmore debate. And let us know. We want to hear your thoughts. So thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Lob Podcast from These Football Times. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.